joined by Eugenia Bone, who is a journalist, a mycologist, and a cook, the former president of the New York Mycological Society, and you've written a number of books as well. So welcome to the show, Eugenia.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
So I met you in Paonia last summer, and you were presenting on, I believe it's your latest book, Microbia.
Yes, that was a great fun. I'm actually going to be talking about bacteria and other tiny critters again in Paonia on the 6th of August.
Okay. I saw on your website that in addition to living in New York, you also consider Western Colorado your home?
Yes. My husband, Kevin, is from Colorado originally. And when he moved to New York to go to college and then started a business and then married me and then I started having children, you know, I think he never really meant to become a New Yorker, but he did. And about midlife time, he just had such a hankering to get back to his roots. So we ended up buying a place, a fixer-upper ranch in Crawford, Colorado. And so we spent years and years taking care of that place and working on it. And I wrote a book about it called At Mesa's Edge. It was my first book. And it was this wonderful experience for the both of us, for Kevin to kind of reconnect with his Colorado roots, and for me to discover mushroom hunting.
Oh, so it was in Colorado that you discovered mushroom hunting?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm from New York.
Right.
You can find mushrooms. Our New York Mycological Society goes to the parks all the time, and we find plenty of mushrooms, but it's nothing like what's going on in, you know, a great wilderness like Colorado has in the Rocky Mountains. So once we had our place, you know, once you have a ranch in Colorado, people come to visit, for sure. I have this friend, Claire Hicks, and he used to say, in Colorado, you've got 3 months of winter and 9 months of company. And it's so true. So I had constant guests, and when they come, they want to hike. And it was when I was on one of those hikes up the Mendicant Ridge that I saw my first Boletus edulis, and after that, you know, the veil was lifted from my eyes, you know, and I became just passionate about hunting mushrooms.
Have you ever written a cookbook?
I have. I've written one, two, three. Well, At Mesa's Edge, which is about fixing up the ranch, it's half cookbook, half memoir about, you know, New Yorkers trying to be ranchers. For Kevin, it wasn't such a stretch. For me, it was a tremendous stretch because I hadn't been any higher than like the windows of the World Restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center. So getting out west was real new territory for me. But I was able to apply my Italian, I'm Italian American, I was able to apply my sort of Italian background in cooking to these incredible ingredients in the North Fork Valley. And so that first book, is half recipes, half memoir. And then I wrote a book with my dad called Italian Family Dining. My dad is still alive, 93, Italian-American, cooking his heart out. And his name is Edward Joby. And then I wrote another book after that called Well Preserved, which was a canning book, and it was a kind of unique one in that there aren't a whole lot of canning recipes, but for every preserved food, there's recipes for utilizing those preserves. And that came out in, I guess, 2000, and maybe it was 2007, something like that. But it was really a kind of new idea at the time, and that one got nominated for a James Beard Award. And then my fourth cookbook is called The Kitchen Ecosystem. And what that cookbook does is it's sort of following in the same kind of passion that I have for, you know, utilizing regional foods but utilizing the whole thing. And those recipes are ingredient-based, apples to zucchini, including meat and fish and poultry. And the recipes are in clusters where there's recipes to eat the product fresh, recipes to preserve the product, recipes to use the preserves, and recipes to use the waste stream, right? So the bones to make stock, or, you know, the apple peelings to use for a pectin, and so on. So it's a very big book, and it's my favorite. But, you know, I also write these popular science books, and sometimes people are like, what?
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, there's an intersection.
Cookbook writing and popular science writing have a lot in common. They both need really precise thinking, for one, and they both really benefit from evocative language, you know, like language that either makes you want to eat to make the recipe, or language that really helps you envision things that might be otherwise too hard to imagine, like the lives of bacteria.
And they're both an exploration as well into, well, in the case of, you know, mushrooms, sort of this unseen world, or all these hidden qualities that these amazing organisms offer to us. And I'm sure knowing some of the science really helps you in preparing the recipes.
Oh, it totally does. That's spot on. In fact, I'm going to talk about, in one of my talks at the Eagle Festival, I'm going to do a talk on how a little mycology can make you a better mushroom cook and help you understand why not only cooking the mushrooms, but how they store, what affects their nutritional value, how to deal with mold, you know, all that kind of stuff that happens in the kitchen has bio roots, you know, and so you can, with a little bit of mycology under your belt, you can actually maybe do a better job as a mycophagist. You know, I love that word, mycophagist. I wonder if your listeners know that carnivores, you know, they're meat eaters, and vegetarians, they're vegetable eaters, but mushroom eaters are mycophagists.
Mycophagists. And there will be a large gathering of mycophagists, as you mentioned, this weekend in Eagle for the Mushroom Festival. This is the 10th annual. Have you attended this festival before or participated as a speaker?
Well, I have participated in the Eagle Mushroom Festival, which is more about mushroom hunting and fungal biology or mycology. But this event is, from what I understand, is unique because it's really about mushrooms and food. So it's focusing on the culinary aspect of fungi. And so while that is always a part of any mushroom festival worth its salt, in this case, the hyper-focus is wonderful because it just means that speakers like myself can really educate, you know, can really get sort of weedy and share what we know on a more granular level than you can when, say, mushroom cooking is one of like a million other talks that are going on and maybe generally more focused toward taxonomy and stuff like that.
So as you mentioned, one of your panels on how understanding a bit of mycology can make you a better cook, and another one on the art and science of preserving mushrooms.
At the Eagle Festival, it would be the first time I'm presenting that talk, even though it's something I have, you know, written about in the past in my various books, and certainly practiced a lot. You know, doing a talk that just focuses on preserving of mushrooms is kind of interesting because it reveals different aspects of preserving, of the science of preserving, that might not so easily be or so articulately be addressed if you had a general preserving conversation. Because mushrooms, there's two things that are going on here. One is all the USDA data is for white button mushrooms. So when you're preserving wild mushrooms, you're kind of flying in the dark. So you have to really make sensible estimations and not, you know, call me up and say, you had sick or you had problems with your product. And the other reality is mushrooms are very alkaline, and as a result, they have to be treated like differently than if you're preserving fruits. Two kind of big aspects of preserving come up in this conversation, and I'll be addressing them. And I've been writing and working on it really for the last week, and it's great fun to sort of think through the processes really well and try to articulate the science in a way that sticks, you know. I mean, when I talk about preserving, I really try hard to explain why we do certain things. Why do you leave headroom in a jar? You know, so often you read a preserving book and it just tells you to do it. And it's a little bit like listening to your GPS, even if it's sending you into a lake, you know? And I think that if people understand why there are these instructions when it comes to preserving, then they are empowered to handle when there's some little aberration, you know, when something isn't exactly the same with your foodstuff, you know, whether it's your mushrooms or you're preserving something else, or whatever little thing can happen, a million can in the kitchen. And if you really if you understand the basic science, then you can address those challenges yourself without worrying about poisoning your family.
Do you have a few favorite species to cook with that maybe aren't as common as some of the ones we see in the store?
Well, what we see in the store, right, are all the saprobes that might be popular with that clientele. So that would be the Agaricus bisporus, right, the white button mushroom. Sometimes you see maitake, which I love wild, and you guys don't really have in the West. You see more of it east of the Mississippi in the wild. You know, and all the oyster mushrooms, but you can collect wild versions of those oyster mushrooms. So in general, I prefer kind of any mushroom that's wild over cultivated. And the reason why is because the wild mushrooms have a stronger and more intense taste. Not that I don't enjoy the cultivated mushrooms. I do. But the wild relatives are, you know, the fungi, I'm going to talk about this in my, you know, how to be a better mushroom cook talk. You know, one of the things I'm going to talk about is this, that fungi are absorptive bodies, right? They get their food by foraging in the soil, or the kind that produce mushrooms anyway, filamentous fungi. They get their food from foraging in the soil where they collect nutrients, or they break down things like plants, right, life forms, and then they absorb the nutrients. And so whatever they absorb, all those micronutrients, is what gets ultimately delivered to the mushroom. In the case of a cultivated scenario, you've got mushrooms growing in like a bag of pretty much sterile sawdust. There is a lot less nutrients, micronutrients, to access. You know, in the wild, there's like a buffet of nutrients that the fungus, depending on its location and size, can access. That's just not going to happen in a cultivated scenario. And micronutrients, they translate, I mean, I'm saying this anecdotally, but they translate into flavor. They certainly translate into a more nutritious product. We all need micronutrients. I mean, the UN said we've got an international crisis of micronutrient malnutrition. I guess it's micro malnutrition. So that's one, you know, kind of overall thing. But the, you know, in terms of like specific mushrooms, I'll never turn down a morel. Never.
And that kind of brings us back to the talk that I saw last summer was all about that sort of microbiome and how important it is that we actually think about our gut as a mini ecosystem full of species that need to be treated well, because if they get out of balance, that's where we see a lot of problems.
Yes, I love to help folks understand the nature of the gut microbiome by comparing it to a park. Yellowstone Park is a great example of what kind of thing goes on in your gut. So in the 1800s, the federal government took the wolves out of Yellowstone Park. They had been predating the rancher's sheep, and they were generally, you know, a nuisance. So out came the wolves. When the wolves left the ecosystem in Yellowstone, then the elk population went crazy, really, really increased in numbers. And the elks, because they didn't have to be running away from wolves all the time, were hanging around the stream bank, and they grazed on all the willows. Without willows, the beaver didn't have material to build dams. Without beaver dams, the river didn't get slowed down. The streams weren't slowed down, and so the nesting birds couldn't come, and the fish couldn't lay their eggs, and so on. It was cascading effects. And then at a certain point in time, environmentalists said, hey, let's put the wolves back into the ecosystem and see what happens. Well, in short order, the elk population diminished actually to a sustainable size for the ecosystem, and they stayed on the hoof. So instead of eating all the willows on the bank, they moved around. The willows came back, the beaver came back, the nesting birds came back, and so on. The ecological balance was restored. Well, the same thing turns out to be true in our guts. It's not like the elk are bad. They're just bad in the wrong numbers for the ecosystem. So likewise, in the park that is your colon, there's no good bacteria or bad bacteria. There's only the wrong numbers of bacteria for the ecosystem to sustain, right? So that's when people say, you know, gut imbalance, what they're really talking about is basic population numbers. Are those population numbers in an evolutionary balance that ensures certain things get done for you in your body, like synthesizing vitamins and producing the component parts of serotonin and protecting your gut wall from, you know, leaky gut syndrome and a host of other very, very important symbiotic duties.
And a lot of that, like in, you know, the macro environments around us, comes through biodiversity, right? The more species there are, the more they sort of balance each other out.
Well, totally. I mean, here's how it works in the gut and also in nature, is that when you have a lot of diversity of species, then you have a lot of different species that are able to provide ecological services for the environment. There's a lot of different jobs that get done, right, to maintain the overall kind of holistic benefit of the ecosystem. Well, the same is true in your gut. If you have less diverse species, or, you know, and also for soil. I mean, in fact, soil is even better, you know, it's an easier thing to understand in a way. If you do industrial agriculture, you'll have in the soil as many microbes as you ever had, but there won't be as many different species. There won't be that diversity of species. And this is because of the use of nitrogen fertilizers and because of tilling and all kinds of different practices that limit or repress the diversification of microbial species. But without that diversity of microbial species in the soil, plants aren't able to access not only micronutrients that are delivered by microbes like fungi, but also the ecological services they can provide in terms of defense and tolerance of ecological disasters like drought or whatever. So the microbial world plays this really important role in host defense and host nutrition acquisition. And when the number of species go down, the less species are available to do different types of host defense and host nutrition. A very easy to understand example would be the case of tobacco plants. The tobacco plants were attacked by sudden wilt disease, which is a type of fungal disease that hangs around the roots, right around the edges of the roots of the plant. Well, what tobacco plants do is that they release exudates, which are like just yummy sugars that they make as a result of photosynthesis, and they leak this stuff into the soil, which attracts the microbes. And one of the microbes that the plants try to attract by leaking out exudates is a bacteria that is an antagonist of sudden wilt. So if there weren't a variety of bacteria and fungi in the soil for the plant to recruit as needed, then the plant is less likely to survive the day. And the same thing goes in your gut. You know, the more diversity of, say, fiber-fermenting bacteria you have in your gut, what that means is you're likely able to break down more different kinds of foods and get nutrition from them, which is helpful if, you know, you go someplace and the only food to eat is seaweed, but if you can't break it down and get nutrition from it, it's not going to do you any good. But if you can, you'll survive the day.
Well, thank you for that brief lesson in microbiology and whole systems.
Oh, my God, I'm sorry.
No, that was great. We really appreciate you.
Well, I'm going to do a talk. That's the talk. Basically, a talk I'm going to do in Paonia on the 6th. I'm going to do a deep dive into all that stuff.
So that's on August 6th at the Paonia Library?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, great. And I imagine some of that's going to come out at the meet and greet on the Friday night of the Mushroom and Wild Foods Festival in Eagle.
Yes, I'm totally planning to be there. You know, I have to say, one of the things I think is going to be so great about this festival is that it has a limited number of people that can come. And what that means is that there can be a lot of interaction between, you know, those of us that are bringing some kind of expertise to the table and folks who are, you know, curious about the subject. We're just going to be able to talk to each other a lot, which is great, because so often in these big mushroom events, the numbers of people and the, you know, the audience sizes and stuff means there's not a lot of space for questions and for discussions and explorations. And this particular one, and the fact that it's like super targeted on mushrooms and eating mushrooms and cooking mushrooms and so on, is I think going to provide a sort of unique opportunity to share information.
Well, Eugenia Bone, thank you so much for speaking with Katie and Kay. Would you like to share your website where people can learn more about you and browse through your books?
Absolutely. It's Eugenia Bone, Eugeniabone, eugeniabone.com. But I also have a Facebook page, and that's where people should just load in if they want to, like, you know, get lots and lots of weird articles from me. So I have Eugenia Bone Books on Facebook, and Eugenia Bone Books, I'm pretty constantly posting stories, things that here's an example of the kind of things that I put up there. Like, I recently put up an observation, really, that, you know, when you have a baby, they put antibiotic drops in the baby's eyes right away. That's left over from in the hospital, right? They put in those antibiotic drops, and that's left over from a time when gonorrhea would cause this really horrible kind of pink eye that could even cause blindness and stuff. So obviously most women aren't giving birth to babies while they're suffering from gonorrhea. I mean, we're kind of past that period, yet the drops are still being given. For other reasons, maybe the mom has chlamydia or something, you know, it can cause less severe eye problems. But the thing is, so the practice continues. It's preventative. But the thing is that baby has an eye microbiome that's really key to long-term vision health. And so I put up on Facebook, you know, this reality about hospitals' use of the antibiotic drops, which is, you know, and I put up the background, the papers and stuff that show, and then this new stuff about the eye microbiome. And so it's those kind of things that I love to put up on my Facebook page and share with people, and then we'll have all kinds of discussions, and people will make other links, and it's lively. So if your readers are interested in anything, you know, in the bacteria, I put stuff up in fungi, bacteria, and viruses. So
all right.
If it's small, I'm interested.
It sounds exciting. I'm in. I'll follow
That's
that.
Good. I look forward to saying hi to you.
All right. Well, travel safe, and we'll look forward to seeing you in Eagle.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on the show.